Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the issue of hypoxia in the Gulf of Mexico. At least since the mid-80s, scientists have been studying an area in the Gulf which has come to be known as the dead zone because oxygen levels in the water are too low to support life. And this is something that is not just a problem for the United States. Many, many dead zones have been identified around the globe. And the concern of many scientists is that the number of these kinds of zones, the number's increasing. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about hypoxia in the world's oceans. And our guest for the program is Dr. Nancy Rabelais. She's the executive director and professor at the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium, and for a number of years now has been doing research on hypoxia in the Gulf of Mexico. Questions certainly welcome as we continue here through this hour of Focus 580. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call and you're listening over the air around Illinois, Indiana, or anywhere in the country on the Internet, use the toll-free line and the call's on us. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point, questions, comments are welcome. The only thing we ask of people who are calling in is that they just try to be brief so that we can keep our program moving along. But, of course, anyone's welcome to call. Dr. Rabelais, hello.
Hello. Hi. How are you?
Fine. Thanks. And yourself?
I'm doing well.
Well.
Down in Cocodrie, Louisiana, which is about as far south as you can go down this road. And we're at the upper end of Terrebonne Bay, which meets the Gulf of Mexico, not too far from here.
Well, I'm pleased that you could be with us. Just to begin here, I guess maybe we ought to talk real basically about hypoxia. That's the technical term for what it is that we're talking about here. What is hypoxia?
Well, hypoxia is really a medical term talking about your blood not having enough oxygen. But in relationship to marine ecology, it's basically water with low oxygen levels. And those low oxygen levels create conditions that normal animals like fish, crabs, shrimp, starfish, they can't survive. And so that's the low oxygen or the hypoxia.
And what is it that causes this condition to occur?
It's a combination of factors. There has to be a water column that's physically structured in such a way to support the hypoxia, and then a high biological production which leads to the hypoxia. So, for instance, in the Gulf of Mexico, the Mississippi River delivers a lot of fresh water, and it forms a two-layer system. That two-layer system keeps the oxygen in the top from going to the bottom because of the layering effect. And the river also brings in very high nutrient levels, which are good to a point. They stimulate the growth of the small phytoplankton, which fuels the food web. But then too much of that material gets to the bottom. And then bacteria that consume carbon, just like we eat a sandwich and we use up oxygen, those bacteria consume that phytoplankton debris and use up the oxygen, and you end up with a depletion below in the lower part of that layered system.
Mm-hmm. So partly the matter is location.
That's part of it.
That's part of it.
If there's not a physical environment that's susceptible to it, it won't happen. If you're in a coastal area with high currents and the water keeps moving quickly by all the time, you're not going to have it. But areas where the water stays around for a while, where there's a lot of fresh water coming in, then you will have that situation, yes.
So this, and one of the things I want to talk about is how it is that the number of these kind of zones have expanded. And according to one of the articles that I've read, and the figure seems a little on the high side, but apparently there's some scientists, and I believe that they were in Sweden, who have identified something like 400 places around the world where this happens. Is this generally the case where you have some large body of fresh water, like a significant river, opening into or flowing into salt water, and it's a situation like the Gulf of Mexico is maybe the second biggest one, but a situation basically like that?
Right. You covered a lot.
I'm sorry. I tend to blather on. Forgive me.
The researchers were Robert Diaz from from Virginia Institute of Marine Science in Gloucester Point, Virginia, and Rutger Rosenberg from Sweden. They wrote a paper in 1995 where I think they documented about 95 of these low auction areas or dead zones. And their most recent article, which is peer-reviewed very well because it's in Science Magazine, premier science journal, indicates that there are over 400 now. I think, barely over 400. And they didn't even probably get to list them all. So there's been a doubling, basically, every 10 years in the number of accounts that show up in the literature, things that you can go to an article and read. Now, there may be more of a... increased reporting and increased scientific papers being written about it, but there are definitely historical data sets that show, yes, there are more now, and if it occurred before, it's more severe than it was in the past. It's definitely a growing trend, and the other part of your question was about in areas where there's high inputs of fresh water. Mm-hmm. That's the case in the Mississippi, Chesapeake Bay. It's not necessarily the same in Long Island Sound or some of the smaller estuaries like Escambia Bay in Florida, other areas. The layered system can be created by just thermal heating from the sun. Just like a lake gets warmer, the top water gets warm and the bottom water stays cold. You go swimming in a lake in August, sometimes your feet are chilly and your arms are quite warm. The same thing can happen in estuaries around the coast. So doesn't have to have a huge freshwater input, but it does have to have that layered system. So the Mississippi River, of course, is the second largest human-caused coastal hypoxic area in the world. But there are many, many others that aren't necessarily associated with a huge river input.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Dr. Nancy Rebele. She is the executive director of the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium and has done a lot of research and writing on hypoxia in the Gulf of Mexico. And that's basically what we're talking about here. We want to concentrate on our part of the world. But the point that we have just made is that, in fact, there are these kind of dead zones that occur around the world, a lot of places. And apparently it's not just that we're paying more attention to them. It is the case that there are more of them. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. The hypoxic zone that we have here in the Gulf of Mexico, I was reading a little earlier this summer that at least at one point, the prediction was that it could be that this year was the biggest ever?
It was predicted based on the amount of nitrate coming out of the Mississippi River in May of this year that it would be the biggest ever. That relationship between the size of the low auction area and the amount of nitrate coming out of the river is a very strong relationship, and statistically or by numbers it explains about 80% of the variation. The other variation, of course, can come from storms or climate conditions, something that would disrupt the water column structure that supports the low auction, and that's exactly what happened to us this summer. We left the dock Sunday evening at midnight and started steaming towards the Mississippi River to start our work, and within one day we were in the feeder bands of Hurricane Dolly as it was crossing the Gulf of Mexico from Yucatan to Brownsville, Texas. So we had a lot of really high waves, and that has the tendency to mix up the water, and the shallower the water, the more easily it mixes up. So when we reached the western part of our study area, which goes all the way from the Mississippi River Delta over well onto the Texas coast and off of Galveston Bay, the shallower waters on that end of the study area had been mixed up. And so the size that we calculated this year was lower than the biggest ever prediction.
Mm-hmm. Has the size, generally speaking, is there a trend that says that it's been, over the years, it's been getting bigger?
Well, the biggest, the trend has been that it has gotten larger, but the size has somewhat leveled off at big. So it's gotten larger, and now it's just big, depending on how much nitrate comes down the river. Mm-hmm. And that's driven, of course, not only by the concentration of the nitrate or nitrogen, but also the amount of water that comes in. So this year, with the floods in the Mississippi River, and this includes both April, when we reached an all-time record high discharge of the Mississippi River, plus the floods in June as well, which, of course, devastated parts of the Midwest. The biggest one in April set the stage, and smaller to us on the overall discharge, although it was certainly not small up in the Midwest, just added an insult to the system, basically. It was already set up and well on its way to low oxygen when the second set of floods happened.
Mm. Let me ask you one other question, and then I have a caller here we'll get to. This is something that the zone tends to wax and wane. That is, it seems to peak, I think, in midsummer, and then as you get into the fall, that it starts to shrink?
Right. Well, as I mentioned earlier, you have to have that physical structure. And in the summer, if you have a tropical storm, it'll mix it up. It usually reforms right away, which has been the case after Dolly and Edward, which was the second one that we got within a very short time period. But then in the fall, we start having more and more cold fronts, and so there's a continual mixing of the water column, and it never really has a chance to settle back into that layered system. And then, so through most of the winter, we don't have it. And then beginning in the spring, with more discharge from the river, more nitrogen load, and as the number of cold fronts start to drop off, then you'll start developing the low oxygen again. And then, of course, in the May through September is when it's the largest and most severe.
Let's talk with somebody here who's calling in. The caller is in Effingham on our toll-free line. This is line number 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Could you go back 1,000 years and could you go back 1,000 years and describe the same thing that you are talking about now? And I have another follow-up.
Okay, well, that's a very good question, because everybody says that the low oxygen has always been there. And, in fact, we have gone back 100 years. We have taken sediments from the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, where the Mississippi River has had an effect for over 7,000 years. And you can look for indicators of high phytoplankton blooms, or you can look at the remains of little animals that live in the sediments and see how they've been affected. And what those sediments tell us is that 1,000 years ago, there was no low oxygen in this area, because the little animals that can't survive low oxygen were very plentiful back then. And if you look at those same animals now, they're almost non-existent in these sediments, which means there's been a shift in the types of animals to those that away from those that can't take the low oxygen to more of those that can take the low oxygen. So that the change over time has been, there's an indication that there were some shifts at the beginning of the 20th century, but most of the changes have taken place since the 1950s, and it's accelerated up till the point right now. So excellent question, but the data, which do go back thousands of years, indicate that no, this is it has not occurred in the past. It has the conditions to have, but it has not. Not that far back.
Yes. Well, my next question would be to comment that I've heard right along about fertilizers and runoff from farm fields and from stock dairies and pig farms and all that sort of thing, and that accumulating and then going down the rivers like everything does, and that effect upon the things that you're describing and the recent hurricanes. There was one I'm thinking of where the runoff from the Texas side created a huge dead zone. It was all kinds of stuff. It was debris from dumps and a whole mass of things, and if that recovered, and then the recent hurricane from Katrina has had the same effect, would be on the east side, I guess. Would you have anything to say about that?
Okay. Okay. You talk as much as David does.
Sorry about that.
No, that's all right. The fertilizers, runoff from the fields, from confined animal feed operations, agricultural sources is about 60% of the amount of nitrogen that gets down to the Gulf of Mexico. Other sources are wastewater treatment plants, just some of the types of crops that are grown, like soybeans, which fix nitrogen and put it into the soil. Just natural weathering of the soil releases nitrogen. Burning of fossil fuels, the fuels we put in our car comes back down in the rain as nitrate. So there are, you know, several sources. And those have changed over the years. And as those have gone up, the low oxygen conditions have gotten worse. With your question about hurricanes, we've had, of course, I'm sitting in a laboratory that's about 4 feet above sea level, although my office, thank goodness, is 18 feet above sea level. But we know when there's a hurricane because the water starts to come in, even with a strong southeast wind. So, let me see, you asked about the area off of Texas. That was in, I think that was 2000 and, let me see, that was 2007. That was last year. And it wasn't hurricane-related rain. It was just that a part of Texas had huge rains, much more than they normally do, and so that washed a lot of water sediments, organic material, nutrients into the Gulf near the Brazos River, and they had an area of low oxygen. It was not near the size of the one that extends from the Mississippi River over to the one that was generated within Texas this year. So if you have a lot of excess rain, runoff nutrients, organic matter, and along that part of the coast, the fairly sluggish currents, they did develop one. It has not been there since then because the input from the river, it's gone back to its average flow. Hurricanes that come through here, 2003, we had a couple that disrupted the low oxygen, but then it redeveloped. 2005, of course, was everybody knows about Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, but we had two before that, Dennis and Cindy, and those are the two that really mixed up the water column so that the area in 2005 wasn't as large as predicted again. But by the time Katrina came through, the low oxygen area had built back up. It was present, and, of course, that hurricane did certainly mix up a lot other than the Gulf of Mexico, mixed up a considerable population and social structure within southern Louisiana, Mississippi. But it did build back up. This year we've had Dolly already. It didn't disrupt the Gulf much because it went further south. Edward started right at the Mississippi River, and it moved west right across our study area, and it disrupted it more, but then it settled back down within about 3 days and was back to the, quote, normal, which is hypoxic for the summer.
Yes, and the last thing, what are we going to do?
What are we going to do? We need a collective societal desire to try to reduce the amount of nutrients that reach the Gulf from all sources, and there are many ways that have been identified that can make a difference. I'm sure people in the Midwest are familiar with all the best management practices that can be employed to either use less fertilizers or keep it on the land or work with a tile drain system to maybe remove some of the nitrates before they get to the nearest stream. It's just going to take, tertiary treatment plants where it's necessary. I think the fuel costs might help reduce the amount of atmospheric nitrate that comes down because we're not going to be able to afford to keep driving the way we're driving right now. It's got to be a collective effort. And right now, everything that's being done is driven by volunteer actions and incentives provided mostly by the federal government through conservation set-asides. The Farm Bill could be changed that those conservation set-asides could be more targeted specifically to reducing nutrients that get into the river besides just, wherever they want them to be. If they really did target where they were located, that might help. And, the economy's driven by factors that are much larger than what's happening in the Midwest and what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico, and we're just a reflection of that. And with everything on Earth, we know more and more that we have to reduce our impact if we want to continue to have a healthy society and ecology.
Just to the bottom line, one bottom line point here, I guess, to go back to underscore in response to what you said to the caller, was that one way or another, the dead zone in the Gulf, and I expect with others that have been identified around the world, these things are the result of human activity.
Yes, yes? They are. There will be some natural ones. If you have some deep water in a fjord that's naturally deep and always deep, and you have, you know, warming of the surface water in the summer, you can have some of these low oxygen areas. But even in areas such as Puget Sound, where those types of conditions have existed over a long, long time, they now are having hypoxia because there's more and more nutrients going into that system. So it's definitely a human-caused situation. Now, there are natural areas of low oxygen in the ocean. The same sort of processes happen, but happen in much deeper water, 500 to 700 meters deep. But that's a very different, that's just like the Mississippi Delta. It's been there for tens of thousands of years, and those conditions have just changed and evolved over time so that there's actually a whole community of animals that can survive in those low oxygen conditions, a completely different community than what lives on a shallow continental shelf such as off Louisiana and Texas.
We are at our midpoint here, and the guest, I'd like to introduce again our guest, Dr. Nancy Rabelais. She is the executive director at the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium and has done a lot of writing and research on hypoxia in the Gulf of Mexico. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. What's been the effect of this hypoxia on the commercial fishery in the Gulf?
Right. That's if you hadn't asked that question, I was going to get to it. One of the issues concerning the whole low oxygen, for one thing, it's very commonly called the dead zone. That's the name that sticks in the public's mind, and that's what people call them. But in fact, the dead zone is not completely dead. There is plenty of oxygen in the surface waters, and in fact, there's an increase in some fish, like menhaden, which end up getting ground up and going to feed and chicken feed up into the Midwest. Interesting how the nitrogen and phosphorus move through the economic cycle down here. But once you get below that, the value is 2 is the one we use in the Gulf, because if you're pulling a shrimp trawl nets over the bottom and the oxygen's below 2, you do not catch a shrimp, you do not catch a red snapper, a croaker, a redfish. Any of the animals that depend on living near or on the bottom just cannot survive, and they move out of the area. So when a trawler puts over a net and they drag and they don't come up with anything, they say, oh, we're in dead water, we're in the dead zone, we have to move. They're smart enough that over the years, as this area has grown and become established, to know where to go to get out of it to look for a shrimp elsewhere. They also have these smaller nets called tri-nets. You put them in the water, you try it out, and if you don't catch anything, you move out of the area. So over the years, and as this thing gets larger and more persistent, the shrimping effort has had to move either further offshore or closer to the beach, where they are sometimes concentrated. And they'll catch lots of them because they're concentrated, but what that does to the overall productivity is it keeps those smaller shrimp from moving offshore and developing into larger shrimp, which would actually bring a larger amount of money to the fishing economy. If you try to put a dollar figure on it, it's very difficult because the price of fuel, a flood of cheap imports of shrimp from overseas, too many ships in the fleet, and other economic variables sometimes will dwarf what's going on with the shrimp fishery, or they'll all confound it. So overall, we still have, you know, we're bringing in money for our shrimp fishery. The shrimpers that, if you just go out and start talking to them, some of them don't think there's a problem. Some of them say, I can't afford to go offshore anymore because I have to go too far to get to the shrimp, and I just can't afford it anymore. Now, that's where we're going to start seeing some economic impacts is if it's just not worth going out to catch them anymore.
Mm-hmm. We were talking a little bit earlier about the fact that the dead zone waxes and wanes, and that it responds to weather conditions, what's going on. And if you have a big storm that churns up the water, that's going to have an impact. There is apparently, though, a concern that, you know, we see the dead zone, it gets to its biggest in the summer, and then once you get into the fall, it starts to shrink, and maybe there is some recovery. There is, I guess, concern about the ability of this territory to continue to recover, and whether you get to a certain point where you get to a tipping point where you say maybe it's gotten so bad that it's not going to recover.
Absolutely. That of course, is a concern. In the Gulf, even though there's oxygen in the fall near the bottom, the communities that live in those sediments have changed. They've been knocked out by the low oxygen. They haven't recovered. I mean, the fish are able to come back in, but those animals that have died off haven't replenished to a sufficient level to provide a good food source for the fish that come back in. So there are some long-term effects on the food chain that can occur. And sometimes that'll carry over into the next year. If you have a really severe low oxygen summer and the new animals that come in the spring from the plankton, it's just not as much as it usually is. One of the other things that's happened with this continual low oxygen over the years is that there's been a major loss of biodiversity. And I'm not talking just about individual species, but losses of whole groups of organisms. For instance, the starfish. We hardly ever find starfish in this area anymore. The number of clams and snails are much reduced over time. There's little shrimp that live in the sediments of a specific type that you just don't find them anymore because the oxygen's too low for them to reproduce enough to repopulate the area. So there has already been a shift in or a loss in biodiversity and a shift in the types of communities that live out there. The long-term effects, if it keeps getting larger, is that it may expand over larger areas. It may be severe. It may last longer. It may take up more of the water column, and that will shift the system to the point of being different. Now, I could say we've already reached a tipping point. We can see in the data that it takes less nitrogen now than it did in the past to create the same large, for the same amount of nitrogen now that there was in the past, there's a much larger low oxygen area in the summer. So we've upped the stakes already. And that's why it's so critical to try to start to do something now, because we've seen a shift in the system, about two shifts now, that have upped the stakes each time. And I don't think over the long term, and I'm thinking long term in thousands of years, even hundreds of years, the system will change naturally. But in the short term, I think there are the possibilities for these tipping points that can lead to a demise of the coastal ecosystem. Given time and given different conditions, there may be enough resiliency for it to come back, but there's no guarantee it's going to come back into the same state that it was before. There's a very good example of this sort of thing happening in the Black Sea. Now, the Black Sea itself has a huge basin that's always anoxic or without oxygen, but they have a continental shelf where the Danube River comes in. It's very similar to the Gulf of Mexico, and they had more and more nutrients up until 1990. They had more and more low oxygen. It used to be the second largest area in the world. Then, unfortunately, with the economic collapse of the Soviet Union, there was less fertilizer available. The nutrients went down. It took about 10 years for the low oxygen to recuperate in that area of the world. But the ecosystem, the food web, and the fisheries have still not yet recovered. So there's a lag in the system. There'll be a lag in the nutrients coming off of the land. There'll be a lag in the Gulf of Mexico or any other water body that has excess carbon stored and excess nutrients stored.
It seems that this is an issue that here in the United States has for a number of years now gotten some coverage. I think the thing that got us interested in talking with you and talking a little bit about this was actually an article that appeared in one of the Chicago newspapers, the uh-huh. Chicago Tribune.
Uh-huh.
But you have to wonder, since the effect happens a long way from here. You know, there's this long distance between the place where the causative agent is in operation, where the farmers are putting the fertilizer on the field. It's a long way down the Mississippi to the point where you actually see the effect. And I find myself wondering whether people up on this end, how conscious they are of the fact that what they do is having a significant impact on another industry that depends on the health of the environment that's down on the other end of the river.
Right. It is hard. It's difficult to perceive or connect the two areas. One thing that I like to stress is that any activity that reduces the nutrients going into the river or into local waterways in the Midwest and upper Mississippi River Basin will improve water quality there, because there are areas in the upper part of the U.S. that do have very poor water quality, stagnant lakes, scum on the water, some of these toxic blue-green algal blooms, too much nitrate in the drinking water, as in Des Moines or Columbus, Ohio at times. So there are local benefits to reducing the nutrients. And, of course, we would, in the Gulf of Mexico would benefit from those reduced nutrients as well. The impact that an individual has on anything in the ecosystem sometimes seems unfathomable, but if you think of the issue of smokestacks and acid rain, where the downfield people had the effects from coal-burning plants in the Ohio River, or Chesapeake Bay, which a lot of their nitrogen comes from the Ohio River Valley, it's just, each gallon of gas that we burn adds to an overall global condition and climate that affects all of us eventually. But it is difficult for an individual to think how that individual's actions, fit into the overall global ecosystem.
Well, this is a kind of thing that, when it does get discussed up here, gets very controversial, because people in agriculture are concerned with their role in this and how people think about that, and often like to stress other sources other than runoff from farm fields for these kind of nutrients getting into the water. Is it fair to say, though, that the greatest contributor is large-scale agriculture, where they're applying large amounts of fertilizer onto farm fields?
Right. It's the amount of fertilizers, it's the crop rotation, the intensity of the crop production, and it's also the artificially drained landscape with the tile drains. All of those combine to create conditions of overload of nitrate into the system. When I talk about low oxygen, and as I have on this radio interview, I try very carefully to point out what all of the sources are, and how the remedies or the mitigation should approach all of the sources. But agriculture is definitely the largest source. If you look at nitrogen forms that come into the river and look to see how they've changed over time, industrial, municipal, atmospheric have pretty much stayed low and consistent, but the input from fertilizer is the one that you can see the huge upward curve in the 60s to the 80s, and it's, of course, leveled off now because we've kind of reached until we started growing more corn for ethanol, we had kind of reached a plateau of the amount of land that was going to be in crop production.
Mm-hmm. And that I know is a concern that a lot of people have, is that because of the interest in producing ethanol, there's more corn being planted, and that means more fertilizer, not just because it's corn, and also because there's more corn acreage.
Right. We've seen the effects of that in the water quality coming down the river. The nitrate concentration is higher now than it has been for the last 10 years. And if you complicate that with floods, then you just get that more nitrogen going into the Gulf. I mean, there's definite changes in the amount of nitrogen that's being delivered now, which puts us in the situation of predicting larger low oxygen areas and actually finding them.
We're coming into about our last 10 minutes or so in this part of Focus 580, and I'd like to introduce once again our guest, Dr. Nancy Rabelais. She is executive director and professor at the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium and is someone who has done a lot of writing and research on this issue of hypoxia in the Gulf of Mexico. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. I wonder, you know, we've talked about several things that can be could be done in terms of remediation or in terms of what can be done to cut down on the amount of these kinds of nutrients that get into the water and that eventually wash down into the Gulf. How much has wetland loss been an issue?
It's a major factor. The wetlands are a natural filter for removing nutrients from the water. And the wetlands that have been lost across the upper part of the U.S. is an incredible loss. And, of course, everybody up there knows that corn grows better if there's not a lot of standing water on the field. So you drain those wetlands, and then you also put the artificial tile drains in, and that moves the water off the land. If you look at the amount of nitrogen reaching a stream or a small river, the more acreage you have in wetlands in that watershed, the less nitrogen you get running off into that stream. So one of the mitigation measures, of course, is putting low productivity or low-lying land back into a wetland situation so it can take some of the nitrate out naturally through the process called denitrification. There's also ways you can engineer tile drains to come up with some sort of ponding mechanism where you could maybe have a similar sort of artificial wetland, take out some of the nutrients before it got to the nearby rivers. There's a lot of concern with, and I think a lot of this has changed because the farmers don't want to lose their soil either, is with putting buffer strips of vegetation along streams, along the fields, so they don't lose soil and the associated nutrients. But that's another way, is buffer strips. And the central part of the U.S. Below Tennessee and towards Louisiana at once was a huge bottomland forest ecosystem that's been drained. And letting some of the floodwaters get back into those systems, I think, would probably also put our natural wetlands to work to remove some more nutrients.
Are these the kind of things that would necessarily be very expensive, or that would involve taking what some people might see as productive land out of production?
Right. Well, the productivity of that land very often is driven by how much per bushel you get for corn. They're still going to be productive lands, but if you're not getting the right price, you might not be farming that land, of course, unless it's subsidized, which a lot of it is. If you look at the overall economy of these different mitigation, the least effective is tertiary treatment, because less of the nitrogen comes from sewage, and it's extremely expensive to put a tertiary treatment onto a sewage treatment plant. Wetlands are very expensive at first to build, but it's capitalized over the long term as those wetlands mature and they take up more and more nutrients. The cheapest in the short term is best cropping systems and fertilizer, and that's, I think, probably to agribusiness, where they fear they would gamble the most if they used less than they do right now. But I think a lot of studies have shown, and some there from University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, researchers have shown that a certain reduction in fertilizer would reduce the amount of nutrients in the river, but still maintain the same crop productivity. And I know crop productivity is the number one issue up there, and it's difficult for people to try to think that they might be gambling with their income that year.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure that people would yes, they're concerned with productivity, but they're also concerned with their input costs. So
right.
if they could be persuaded that by using less fertilizer, they could get the level of productivity they wanted and be paying less money because they would be using less fertilizer, I'm sure farmers would respond to that if you could assure them that the productivity was where they would want it to be.
Right.
If you could say you can have that and pay less money because you're going to be buying less fertilizer, I'm sure a lot of farmers would say, well, sure, of course we'd do that. We'd be stupid not to do that.
Right, right. Well, that's the economic benefit for the farm economy. And as natural gas prices continue to go up, which they are, and the cost of fertilizer production goes up, which it will and has, then the economy of the farm, with fertilizer being such a minimal part, besides the mortgage and the machinery and the personnel, will become more and more of a consideration in the overall budget of the farm, and it may stimulate some reduction in fertilizer use. It's happened in other parts of the world that are not as affluent as us, and there is less fertilizer being used in some areas, and there's been some improvement in water quality as well.
Mm-hmm. I wonder when you're looking at some of these dead zones around the world, and you talked about the fact that they seem to be, there are more of them. It's not just that they're being studied to a greater degree, there are more of them. How much of them do appear around centers of population that may be near the, maybe coastal, or that somehow, that then this is not involved in agriculture, but it's the other kind of effluent things that are just the kind of waste that you get when you have large populations of people,
right.
and that's, you can have the same thing with a kind of runoff, sewage, other kind of runoff that you just get when you have a large urban area.
Right, right. It's a combination of both crowded populations in coastal areas and localized water quality problems. But there are also the larger issues. For instance, the Xinjiang or the Yangtze River has flowed across China for eons and gone into the East China Sea. And as the Gulf of Mexico, there was no low oxygen there before. And now they have a low oxygen zone. It's lagging in time to what's happening in the U.S. and other developed countries. And they are moving to larger and larger agricultural practices and more fertilizer. That's an example of a system that's changed from non-point source runoff due to the same things that have happened elsewhere in the world. Another one is the Pearl River in China, the Huanghe, which is the Yellow River, and it's the same situation. It's non-point diffuse nutrients coming off the land because of changes in landscape use or agricultural practices that go into a water body that's receptive or ready to form a low oxygen zone, even though there hasn't been one there historically. So the increase in number, and in South America, I gave a talk on the Mississippi River there once, and they said our rivers are too large to have that sort of a problem. Well, the Mississippi River is the seventh largest river in the world, but in the very same place where I gave that talk in the Pajaran, they now have a low oxygen zone at the end of that river. So people aren't immune, and systems are not immune because the economy is driving, and the desire for people to have a better quality of life is driving many of the things that we do to our ecosystems.
Mm-hmm. We have just about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, I just like to mention to folks, the questions are welcome. If somebody wants to call right in, we can get them in. We're talking with Dr. Nancy Rabelais. She is the executive director of the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium, and we're talking about the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Yes, go ahead.
I did a similar interview with Jean Turner from LSU in your studio there, probably 8 years ago, and it was a very interesting conversation because maybe somebody will get the hint and call in. A farmer on his tractor in the field actually called in and asked a question about what can we do, and so I actually got to talk to somebody, you know, on the land at the time, and it was very interesting back and forth. So.
Well, you know, I thought for sure that I had talked to you before and that you had been here and we had that conversation. And we looked at our records and maybe our records don't go back. Our database didn't go back far enough because I said, well, put her name in there and see if she had been here on the program. Well, I'm glad to know. Yes. In fact, my memory is somewhat still intact and that it was, in fact, you. So this is something that's not going away. People have been paying attention to it now for a number of years, and as you say, it still seems to be a real concern.
Right, right. And as you mentioned, I've been doing this sort of work for a while, but you start counting the years, and it's almost a quarter of a century right now. I like to think of it as 24 years, but.
Well, we do have a caller here. We're going to get in, and someone who is listening in Indiana, and on our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Hi. I'm sorry I haven't had a chance to hear all of your talk today, but the one thing I'm always interested in with the dead zone is that, I just wonder what has changed because, 20 years ago we were putting on, fertilizer. We were still using a huge amount of nitrogen fertilizer 20 years ago. We had more runoff from livestock operations, and in fact, our efficiency with nitrogen fertilizer was a lot less back 20 years ago than it is now. I mean, everything, back when nitrogen was cheap, people would just pour it on, and it was no problem. Now you don't dare want to do anything. Is it weather patterns, or is there some other major change that's happened that's caused this? Because I see farming as a whole is much more efficient and much more less wasteful of nutrients than it was 20, 30 years ago.
Right. I'd say you're probably correct about that, and it's going to have to become more efficient as the price of fertilizer goes up. We talked about tipping points earlier in the show and how an ecosystem can change from one state to another, and we've probably passed that first or second tipping point in the Gulf of Mexico because the doubling in the load came between the 60s and the 80s.
Oh, okay.
And now you see, you basically see the nitrate load following both application to the land and weather patterns with more runoff. But as there actually is more acreage of land, especially in the last several years, And so that just means more fertilizer into the system. But what we've also seen is
there's more acreage of land.
There's more marginal land going into production to generate the biomass for ethanol.
Okay.
So that's pretty well documented. And the amount of increase in fertilizer use is pretty well documented as well.
Yeah, we grew as many acres of corn this year as we did in 1940, or last year as we did in 45, I think. So there is, it kind of goes in cycles.
Yeah, and we do know, though, from taking the water measurements, U.S. Geological Survey in New Orleans and Baton Rouge, that the amount of nitrogen per water that comes down now is much higher than it was historically. But the amount of water is going to drive totally how much gets down there. There's just more now.
Yeah, I guess I'm just I still go back to the amount of nitrogen we're putting on and the amount that we're removing with grain. And I know the efficient. I mean, this stuff is $1,000 a ton now. And back 30 years ago, I don't know what it was. I mean, $100 a ton or whatever. And you just can't afford to waste a penny's worth of it. And I just hope we're not pointing the finger at something, and we're not really. And there might be some other source of the nitrate. I don't know. But
people that have done the budgeting, U.S. Geological Survey and others, they've done it lots of different ways. And some budgets actually include the nitrogen that goes off the land. They only count certain things, and that would be fertilizer, atmospheric deposition, and legumes. And they still come up with the fertilizer. And that's taking the nitrogen out of the system as well. It still puts the fertilizer use as the number one input. But you're right. Everybody is going to feel the pinch from the increase in price of fuel, which means an increase in the price of anhydrous ammonium, and some people are going to urea. Economically, it's very interesting. A lot of the anhydrous ammonium that goes onto the fields in the Midwest is actually generated here in Louisiana.
Right, right. Yes,
and
that's a big pipeline right up through Indiana.
Right, right. You see the black tanks on the train, you know, going up, leaving Baton Rouge, and pipelines as well. So,
well, very good. Well, hey, thank you very, very much. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you. We're trying to get in real quick. One caller here more in Chicago, line one. Hello.
Good morning. I know you're short on time, but can this land be recycled, and will it get so bad that finally you have to say everyone has to leave that land?
I think there's. I think there could be a shift in types of agricultural use and more to a sustainable system. And I think yes, I think the land can recover with the right kind of care.
We are essentially at the point that we have to finish. And I guess that there is sort of an open question about how this is going to play out, and whether in fact it sounds as if it is a solvable problem. And the recovery that we're talking about in some of these dead zones could take some time, but that it's something that we know how to address. The question, I suppose, is: are we in fact going to do that?
I think you're correct. We do know what to do. It's just socially, politically, and economically, if it's going to be an acceptable course of action.
And what do you think long-term, I realize that this is a slightly different question, but it's something that you're in touch with. What do you think long-term are the prospects for the fishery there? You know, given a lot of things that affect the health of the ocean environment and the energy costs and so forth.
Right. Well, the fisheries are hammered from lots of different directions, including overfishing and water quality. And it's just part of the bigger mix that the fisheries are another resource that we need to pay very close attention to, or we're not going to have enough to spread around when we really, really need it in the future.
Well, there, I guess we'll have to leave it. I guess Dr. Nancy Rabelais, she is the executive director of the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium, and she's done a lot of research and writing for a number of years now on the issue of hypoxia in the Gulf. And Dr. Rabelais, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, David. It's been a wonderful experience once again, and maybe we'll talk again in the future.
All right. We appreciate that.
All right.